As you may have heard, the UK is one step closer to allowing the creation of babies with DNA from two women and one man. This is complex, so bear with me. It all centres around mitochondrial DNA. Some women's mitochondrial DNA actually carries genetic diseases, so scientists have developed a technique that allows the DNA from two parents to be combined with a second woman's healthy mitochondria to ensure that the genetic disease is not passed on to the next generation. A law enabling this to happen has passed the lower house of UK's Parliament, and the House of Lords will now consider the bill. But it's actually promoting concern in both the UK and here in Australia. Of course, it's launched a bit of an ethics debate. Joining me now to discuss the issue is Professor Justin St John. He's the director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research, based in Melbourne. Welcome to RN Drive.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Now, can you explain simply how this actually works?
Yes, it's a very simple technique, because women who are carriers of mitochondrial disease have their eggs fertilized, and then the union of the sperm and the egg is transferred to another egg from a woman who doesn't carry mitochondrial disease.
Can you give us an idea of some of the diseases and how they affect the sufferers, This is such a huge issue and such a big breakthrough?
Yeah, so some of these diseases are severely debilitating. They can affect both adults and children, and they can restrict the lifespan of individuals quite severely. So individuals can suffer from things like loss of sight and hearing, severe muscle weakness and pain, spasms. They're often unable to walk, eat, or swallow normally. They can suffer from strokes or seizures. They can suffer from heart diseases, respiratory problems, problems digesting food. And they also can suffer from intellectual disability as well.
And how much of the second woman's mitochondrial DNA goes into the child, for instance? Could it affect or contribute to appearance? I'm wondering what it means for the genetic creation of this child.
Yeah, so the mitochondrial DNA is primarily associated with producing energy. And it's an important process which enables us to be able to function normally. Now, we probably wouldn't look at an individual and say this individual has inherited its mitochondrial DNA from here or there, but we know that populations of mitochondrial DNA can contribute to a specific phenotype. So, for example, an individual might be more prone to be faster or slower in terms of their sports abilities, in terms of their performances, because they've inherited their mitochondrial DNA from one population or another. But what's becoming more and more interesting is that mitochondrial DNA can contribute indirectly to a host of other diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, and there's a strong contribution from the mitochondrial genome to cancer as well. So we need to be very careful in how we select the population of mitochondrial DNA that we use for this specific type of treatment.
On RN Drive, we're talking with Professor Justin St John. He's the director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research, based in Melbourne. In the UK, those opposed to this have called it a slippery slope and saying that it's effectively, ethically, really quite questionable. The UK regulator said it would assess each individual case. Is that enough of a safeguard, in your view, to ensure that this does not lead to all of the things that most of these people are fearing?
Well, I think that we also have a moral responsibility to ensure that diseases like mitochondrial disease don't persist in our society. And if we can eradicate this disease by using a simple technique that will prevent it from going from one generation to another, I think that's a positive outcome from this. I think we want to avoid children suffering and adults suffering from these types of diseases. There's certainly a burden on their families. There's certainly a burden on the healthcare costs. And this is really a technique which can lead us a step further forward here.
You've welcomed this step, but you've also said that you'd like more study, more research before adults go ahead and conceive this way. Why do you think we need more research?
With this technique, when we take out the mother's and father's chromosomes from the egg and transfer them to the donor egg, we're taking across with that package a small amount of defective mitochondrial DNA as well. Now, the way mitochondrial DNA passes through the egg into the fetus and then into the offspring is very different from our understanding of how the chromosomal genes pass from one individual to another. So what we need to understand is how these defective mitochondrial DNA, which might be transmitted, would be selected for or against in the embryo and then during development in the mother's womb and then as the offspring is born. And we're not totally clear about this. And one thing that really points to us really needing to know this is that, you know, there's 1 in 200 individuals are carriers of mitochondrial disease. And most of those individuals don't know that. But suddenly, within the family, a child is born with this mitochondrial disease because the mutated mitochondrial DNA has been selected for at some stage during development of that individual. So we want to make sure that that sort of effect doesn't happen to subsequent generations and to also the offspring for whom this treatment would have been devised for.
I wonder if I can get your views on this. People often raise concerns about designer babies. This is effectively really at the centre of this debate. Ethical concerns about people making decisions about what they want their attributes of their babies to be. How does this link to that debate? Do you see this as providing the potential for that to become the way that people organise their families in the future? And do you have ethical concerns about that?
No, so I think this is very different. Here we're talking about the preventing the transmission of a disease to an offspring. We're not talking about selecting an individual because that individual, we want an individual who has got blonde hair and blue eyes or whatever. This is a totally different outcome. We're trying to prevent a disease from being transmitted through. Now, there are other diseases which can be selected for at the embryo, and that sort of technology is in place. Whether this leads to designer babies in the future, well, I think that's the case for the regulators and for society to decide. But lawmakers can specify and say, look, certain technologies should only be used in certain circumstances. And I think in the case of the UK, that they've made an exception here. The matter has been debated by bioethicists, it's been debated by scientists, and it's been debated by policymakers. And a consensus has come forward to say that, in principle, this should go ahead. And I think that's the case. That should be the case on an individual basis for each type of manipulation that might take place with eggs, sperm, and embryos.
Do you imagine, though, let's look to the future, that there'll be more and more of this. There'll be more technology like this and more capacity for these sorts of decisions to be made with other diseases potentially. So keeping an ethical look at what you accept and what you don't will become more onerous, if you like.
Well, I think, you know, we're developing more and more technologies in lots of different spheres of life, and we look at those in great detail each time. I think that here we have a technology which has the chance to eradicate a disease, and that's where the debate is, and that's where the debate should be, because we need to ensure that the health of the offspring is the paramount thing. Now, when we have the opportunity to progress with these types of treatments, but they will have knock-on effects for other types of manipulations, but that doesn't mean that people are going to run out and do these. And I think, you know, we're taking away the element of control that the individuals who decide to have families have, to the extent that, you know, still, there are a large number of individuals who conceive, they have a scan in the hospital, and they choose not to know the sex of the individual, of the child that they're going to have, because they want the element of surprise at birth. And I think, you know, most people will think that this technology which is available is specifically for one particular disease, and that's where its limitations are, and that's where it will stay.
Where does Australia fit in with all this? Would you like to see Australian legislators introduce laws to legalise this here?
Yeah, I'd like to see that happen over the next few years. My view is that we need to sort out the science of this properly before we ask Parliament to discuss this in earnest and to make a ruling on this. I think that I would be much happier to present politicians with a full detailed picture based on sound scientific evidence from work that which we conducted over the next 3 to 5 years. I think for Australia it's maybe a little premature to do that, and I think because this has gone through the UK Parliament in such a hurry, I think there's going to be a backlash on the introduction of this technology at earlier stages in countries like Australia. And I know that the FDA in the USA has certainly asked for this not to be considered as of yet. In fact, they've come out and ruled that this should still be banned.
Professor Justin St. John, thanks so much for joining me on RN Drive.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Professor Justin St. John. He's the director of the Centre for Genetic Diseases at Monash Prince Henry's Institute of Medical Research, based in Melbourne. You're on RN Drive with me, Patricia Carvelis.